We interrupt our regularly scheduled broadcast this morning to bring you breaking news. The FDA has approved lumateperone, Caplyta, for bipolar depression. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Haken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. The winter holiday season is always one of great anticipation for us at the Carlette Report. With our winter double issues safely in the mail, we have time to sit beneath the twinkling lights and Festivus pole and wonder what the coming week will bring. Who will come to visit, or at least Zoom, and what gifts will they bring? And what medications will the FDA approve as their final quarter closes? That's right, most psychiatric medications are approved in the last week of December. And on December 20th, 2021, the FDA delivered lumateperone, Caplyta, for bipolar 1 and 2 depression.
That right there is a first, because no other medication specifically lists bipolar 2 in its indication. The manufacturers of lumateperone made a bold move of enrolling a lot of bipolar 2 patients in its FDA registration trials. Only one other atypical antipsychotic has a lot of data in bipolar 2, and that's quetiapine, Seroquel. Quetiapine doesn't have the bipolar 2 word in their official indication for bipolar depression, but it is mentioned in the prescribing information that the approval was based on studies in bipolar 1 and 2. Okay, so it's unique, but does it really matter? I mean, wouldn't you think that anything that works for bipolar 1 depression would also work for bipolar 2 and vice versa? Sometimes that is true, but it was not true for the last atypical that got approved in bipolar depression, cariprazine, Vraylar. That one failed in its bipolar 2 studies, so the company stopped enrolling bipolar 2 patients and stuck with the traditional bipolar 1 depression.
Bipolar 1 and 2 use the same criteria for their depressive phases in DSM-5. So what's the difference between the two?
Well, to me, bipolar 2 is closer to recurrent major depression than it is to bipolar 1 disorder. Just look at the symptoms. On average, people with bipolar 2 spend 50% of their lives in some form of depression and only 4% of their lives with hypomania or mixed states. So the numbers already give a hint that this is a depressive illness. For bipolar 1, it's 30% in depression and 15% in mania or mixed states. The nature of the symptoms are also different. Bipolar 2 is more likely to have atypical features like overeating, oversleeping, and leaden paralysis during depression, while some studies show that bipolar 1 has a greater tendency to the opposite, melancholic features. In bipolar 2, the depressions are more mixed with psychiatric comorbidities, and these occur at alarmingly high rates in both kinds of bipolar, but particularly in bipolar 2 patients. Things like anxiety disorders, OCD, ADHD, post-traumatic stress disorder, bulimia, addictions, personality disorders, and temperamental problems like cyclothymia and dysthymia. A lot of times you're going to see those mixed in with the depressions in bipolar 2.
Okay, so I'm just speculating now, but it's starting to make sense to me why quetiapine would be favorable in bipolar 2, because it treats a lot of those comorbidities. Quetiapine treats anxiety disorders, OCD, and borderline personality disorder. And arguably, quetiapine contains something that other atypicals do not, an antidepressant. One of its metabolites, norquetiapine, acts like an SNRI.
That is intriguing. And I'm not saying that patients with bipolar 2 depression do better with antidepressants, although they are closer to the unipolar side than the bipolar 1 side in that respect. I mean, on the downside, we have lots of evidence that antidepressants cause rapid cycling in both bipolar 1 and 2, and we don't have much evidence that antidepressants help bipolar 2. But, you know, this really just hasn't been adequately studied. But the expert consensus is that a small minority of bipolar patients respond to antidepressants, maybe 10 to 20%. These responses are not so great, And the meds might be doing some harm, like increasing the frequency of episodes, rapid cycling, even while they do some good, like treating anxiety or depression. And the expert consensus is also that if a patient with bipolar disorder is going to respond to an antidepressant, they are more likely to have bipolar 2 than bipolar 1.
But lumateperone is not an antidepressant, to be clear, right?
Right. Unlike quetiapine, it does not contain an antidepressant metabolite or have an antidepressant structure. Lumateperone is a unique antipsychotic, though, in that it treats psychosis without significant dopamine D2 blockade. Its receptor occupancy at D2 is 39%, while most antipsychotics occupy the D2 receptor at 60% and above. So how does it treat psychosis? Some think lumateperone might treat psychosis through serotonergic 5-HT2A antagonism, and in these ways, its mechanism overlaps a bit with that of quetiapine, which is also low on dopamine blockade and high on serotonergic 5-HT2A antagonism.
That's interesting, because psilocybin is a psychedelic that is trying to gain FDA approval for depression, and it is a serotonergic 5-HT2A agonist, as are other psychedelics like LSD. Someday I hope to find out how two drugs with opposite mechanisms of action can both treat depression.
Yes, and some antidepressants also block this 5-HT2A receptor, like trazodone, nifazodone, and mirtazapine. Another antipsychotic that shares a similar profile with lumateperone and quetiapine is pimavanserin, Nuplazid, which also has low dopamine blockade. That's why the FDA approved it for Parkinsonian psychosis. And it also blocks serotonin 5-HT2A. And like lumateperone, pimavanserin is showing promise in depression. In this case, in the randomized controlled CLARITY trial, where pimavanserin worked as antidepressant augmentation in unipolar major depression.
So quetiapine, lumateperone, and pimavanserin might be loosely lumped together as 5-HT2A blockers with low dopamine blockade. All of these drugs also improve sleep, which many patients appreciate. Although on the other hand, fatigue is a main side effect for lumateperone and can be a problem with the other two as well. Outside of that, the three really differ in their side effects. Quetiapine has more weight gain and metabolic issues, and although it was rumored to have low rates of tardive dyskinesia, a 2018 meta-analysis concluded that quetiapine had the highest risk of tardive dyskinesia among the atypical antipsychotics. And pimavanserin is a wild card. It was approved through an expedited pathway, so the studies on it are pretty small. And post-marketing surveillance data suggests possible trouble with long-term morbidity and mortality on it, including a recent analysis from late 2021. But we can at least say that these three antipsychotics have low rates of extrapyramidal symptoms, like muscle stiffness, cogwheeling, and akathisia, along with clozapine, which could be added to this group. And that makes these a good choice for psychosis in Parkinson's disease.
Let's talk about side effects, because that's where lumateperone stands out. In the schizophrenia and bipolar studies, lumateperone had similar rates as placebo for akathisia, extrapyramidal symptoms, prolactinemia, and the dreaded metabolic symptoms of weight gain and lipid or glucose abnormalities. Its main side effects are fatigue, dry mouth, nausea, and dizziness.
That sounds pretty tolerable, but this is a new drug, so I'm guessing those are just short-term studies.
In bipolar disorder, they are short-term, 6 weeks. But in schizophrenia, they did an uncontrolled extension study for 1 year that did confirm this favorable profile. I put more trust in the low rate of akathisia and extrapyramidal symptoms, as those kind of side effects tend to show up early in the treatment.
So lumateperone might be used for bipolar 2 depression, and you might consider it when a patient is unable to tolerate other atypical antipsychotics. Anything else we should know about this drug?
Yes, it's a good choice for bipolar 2 depression, and lumateperone works for bipolar 1 depression as well. I should point out, in the studies, they did a post-hoc analysis, and they actually found lumateperone had a better response in the bipolar 2 than the bipolar 1 patients, which is unusual for atypical antipsychotics. Usually we get better data in bipolar 1. Lumateperone's approval was based on 3 randomized controlled trials, only one of which has been published, and we review it in next month's February report. But we were able to get abstracts of the unpublished studies. Here's what we found. The first trial was negative. It didn't work. But lumateperone worked in the next 2 trials with a small to medium effect size, that is 0.27 to 0.56, which is similar to the range we see for other atypicals like lurasidone. And the benefits it brought about in depression showed up as early as week 1, which is also common with this kind of medication. One of those trials was as an adjunct to other mood stabilizers. That was a positive trial. And the other 2 were using lumateperone as monotherapy, of which one of those was positive and one was negative.
How do you explain the negative finding?
I can only speculate on that. It was a large multi-center trial, and you know, the more centers there are in a trial, the more likely you are to get a negative result. In this case, there were 58 study centers around the world.
Why do more centers reduce the chance of a positive result?
It's not really the number of centers, but when the ratio of investigators to subjects goes high. And, you know, when you have more centers, you tend to have a lot more investigators dosing their attention out on small groups of subjects. It's really that the more attention those subjects get, the higher the placebo response is going to be. That's the bottom line. And the higher the placebo response, of course, the more likely the study's going to be negative. In lumateperone's case, the placebo response was 1.7 times greater in the negative trial than it was in the positive ones.
But on the other hand, maybe the drug is not that effective. I mean, one of the positive studies you quoted had an effect size of 0.27, which is about the same as the effect size of omega-3 fatty acids in bipolar depression.
Good point. And omega-3s are generally good for physical health, which is more than I can say for antipsychotics. We have an article on how to use omega-3s coming up in our March issue, which is an exciting one because we found new data on how to refine the dosing of these agents.
Now that the approval is in place, what does the future hold for lumateperone?
A 4th trial is underway that will test the drug in a 3rd group, unipolar depression with mixed features. This is a new concept in DSM-5 that recognizes patients with unipolar depression who have at least 3 manic symptoms during their depression. Previously, these patients were said to have bipolar spectrum depression or agitated depression. And, you know, only one medication, that's lurasidone, Latuda, has robust data in unipolar depression with mixed features. So this will be interesting to see if lumateperone is positive there as well.
But that also reminds me of a drawback of lumateperone. It has no data in mania, and neither does lurasidone for that matter. Would you use these meds for mania?
Only as a last resort. Just because something is an antipsychotic does not mean that it treats mania. We covered the negative trials of brexpiprazole and iloperidone last October's podcast.
Lumateperone is approved as monotherapy for bipolar 1 and 2 depression because it was studied that way. But this is more reflective of the clunky binary thinking of the FDA than a thoughtful recommendation. We don't recommend lumateperone as monotherapy in bipolar 1 because mania destroys lives, and lumateperone has no evidence to prevent mania. But what about in bipolar 2, Dr. Aiken?
Well, you've just touched on 2 misconceptions in bipolar disorder. The first is that all bipolar patients need long-term mood stabilizers. That recommendation was created for bipolar 1 to prevent those life-destroying manias. But bipolar 2 patients don't have manias, and they rarely have hypomanias. So they need something to treat and prevent depression. And like I've said, that's not necessarily an antidepressant. In fact, probably is not an antidepressant. So what do you do to treat and prevent depression? Well, in bipolar 2, you're going to get the best balance of tolerability and efficacy for most patients with lamotrigine and possibly lithium. But could you use lumateperone for long-term monotherapy in bipolar 2 disorder? I just don't know. We don't have the research on that. Go back to our October podcast and you'll see that a lot of these antipsychotics don't have robust data for preventing depression in bipolar. Maybe quetiapine does. The second misconception in bipolar disorder is that the DSM's way of separating bipolar into types 1 and 2 is the only way of slicing the pie. Now, that is useful because the DSM points to the need for an anti-manic agent in bipolar 1, but I get just as much utility out of another concept that was crystallized by Fred Goodwin in his book, Atypical Bipolar Disorders. He speaks of the difference between atypical bipolarity, where there are a lot of mixed states, rapid cycling, and complex comorbidities like anxiety, addiction, and personality disorders, and on the other hand, classic bipolar. That's where the manias or hypomanias are pure euphoric types, the textbook cases, and the depressions and manic states are cleanly separated, with good functioning between the two, and not a lot of comorbidities except maybe panic disorder. So that's atypical versus classical bipolar, and here atypical does not refer to atypical symptoms like we see in depression. It just refers to the fact that there's a whole lot of other stuff going on, mixed states, anxiety, that confuses the picture.
Sounds like these distinctions, atypical and classical bipolar, can apply to both bipolar 1 and 2 patients.
Yes, either one can have it, although you do tend to see the atypical form more often in the bipolar 2 patients. The atypical form also has an earlier onset, tends to start in childhood or at puberty. And these patients rarely reach full recovery. Often, they have milder mood, anxiety, or temperamental problems that continue after their major episode is resolved. In contrast, the ones with classic bipolar, they tend to have the illness start between age 15 and 20, and they tend to have full recovery between their episodes.
Why is the atypical versus classical distinction important?
Because it informs treatment. Classical bipolar is more likely to respond to lithium, whether they have bipolar 1 or 2, while atypical bipolar is more likely to respond to anticonvulsants and antipsychotics. In fact, one of our colleagues, Nasir Gami, wrote a paper suggesting that the classical form should be renamed Cade's disease, after the Australian John Cade, who discovered lithium.
So you might use lithium in bipolar 2.
Definitely, if the patient has the classic type of bipolar. About 1 in 3 patients with bipolar disorder do have the classic form, and these patients are great lithium responders. Lithium can also be tried in atypical bipolar. It's not like you should avoid it. It is less likely to work there, but then again, you know, most treatments are less likely to work in that population. They're, as I said, less likely to have full recovery.
Let's end with a rundown of the atypical antipsychotics in bipolar depression. At this point, the only ones that have positive control data are the ones that are FDA approved, so you don't have to search too hard to find them. Starting with generics, they are olanzapine-fluoxetine combination. Dosed as 6 mg olanzapine with 25 mg fluoxetine, or up to double those amounts of each. Some insurers will require you to write for the two as separate scripts, even though the combo pill is generic.
A lot of people think that insurers have an unfair bias against branded drugs, but this is not true. Their mission to impede care is a universal one. Generic drugs, brand name drugs, both. If you think you can escape their scrutiny by sticking with generic drugs for FDA-approved indications, like olanzapine-fluoxetine combination, clomipramine, and even some of the older MAOIs, think again.
The other generic is quetiapine. For bipolar depression, the optimal dose is 300 milligrams a night, and either the XR or instant release will work. Higher doses treat mania and mixed states, like 400 to 800 milligrams a night. And now for the brands. Cariprazine Vraylar works in bipolar depression and mania, but has a possible lower efficacy in bipolar depression with a number needed to treat of 11, about half of the efficacy of the others in its class. The dose for bipolar depression is 1.5 milligram a day, and for mania is 3 to 6 milligram a day. Lurasidone, Latuda, approved for bipolar depression in adults and children over age 12. This one needs to be taken with mood, and it has some evidence of a dose-response relationship between 20 milligram and 120 milligram a day. That's unusual because most of these drugs work for depression in low doses and mania in high doses. But lurasidone also stands out because it does not have evidence in mania. And finally, lumateperone. If you're going to use lumateperone in bipolar depression, the dosing is the same as it is for schizophrenia. 42 milligrams once at night. The starting dose is the same as the ending dose. Taking it with food may improve tolerability by dampening and delaying the peak blood level, but it's not necessary for absorption. It is metabolized through CYP3A4 and isn't known to have active metabolites.
And now for the word of the day, mu opioid receptor.
It's through the mu opioid receptors that opioid medications treat pain. As these receptors are densely concentrated in brain regions that regulate perception of pain. The mu receptor also shows up in the amygdala, where it influences the emotional response to pain. These pain receptors can develop tolerance to the analgesic effects of opioids, which explains why long-term opioid therapy doesn't work so well for chronic pain. But it does not explain why opioids are addictive. Addiction, abuse, and a use disorder are different from tolerance. To explain the addictive qualities of opioids, we have to turn to the ventral tegmental area and nucleus accumbens, which register the rewarding and euphoric properties of opioids.
But none of this fully explains the opioid crisis. The opioid crisis is not just about tolerance and addiction to these drugs. It's also about accidental overdose. We're not talking here about suicide, although that can come up. We're talking about accidentally taking more opioids than prescribed, or taking the prescribed amount with alcohol, a benzo, or another respiratory depressant, or with the respiratory illness on board. Opioids cause death through respiratory depression, and the mu receptor in the brainstem is the one that's responsible for that effect. Join us next week where we detail the history of the opioid epidemic. It's a story of medical misconceptions, industry corruption, and the loss of life for over a million Americans.
With the release of the first FDA-approved medication for bipolar 2, we can expect to see a lot more industry-sponsored education on this disorder. But you can get ahead of the tide with Dr. Aiken's unsponsored bipolar 2 textbook, Bipolar Not So Much, available in print and audio editions from W.W. Norton. David Dunner, who developed the concept of bipolar 2 almost 50 years ago, had this to say about it. This informative book is easy to read and provides practical information. It includes information on diagnoses, medications, and psychosocial and lifestyle approaches to bipolar 2. Personally, I've used it so much with my patients that I've worn out the cover.